From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in Houston, today officials are saying that more than 2,000 people have been rescued from the devastating floods that are washing that city. Hurricane Harvey has been downgraded to a tropical storm, but it is expected to bring heavy rains for at least another 2 days. Today, Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said the priority right now is to help those still trapped in their homes.
Especially seniors, those with disabilities, those in life-threatening situations, okay? That is the focus, and the goal is to get to them before the day is out.
Well, joining us with more is NPR's Rebecca Hersher. She's part of the team covering the aftermath of this storm. Hi there, Rebecca.
Hello.
Well, first of all, I understand that you've actually been unable to get to Houston because of this catastrophic flooding. So what are you seeing where you are?
Well, yeah, I've driven all over this part of the state in the last 2 days, sort of trying to get a lay of the land and also trying to get into Houston, as you said, unsuccessfully. And what I'm seeing here, we're about 70 miles west of Houston in a town called Columbus. And what we're seeing is the major interstates, I-10, runs sort of straight west out of Houston, and it is flooded. And it's crazy to see something like this because this is a major road. This is a place where a lot of shipping happens coming from the Gulf, a lot of trucking, and there are hundreds and hundreds of trucks just along the highway. Mm. No one's able to move. Last night as we came in, we were stopped at a roadblock at about 3 a.m. by local police who said, "We don't have any information, but the road ahead of here is totally covered in water." Now, this morning when we woke up, we continued past that place. The water had gone down, but we got to Columbus, and there's flooding here. So wow. It's sort of moment by moment.
So obviously impacts you're seeing right there outside of Houston, even though a lot of the public's attention has been focused on the devastation going on in Houston. But the impacts to surrounding areas is something that FEMA Administrator Brock Long actually talked about a little earlier today.
These impacts are not only across Houston, but 50 different counties within Texas. We're also going to see a tremendous amount of rainfall into the southwest Louisiana. We're asking citizens to still listen to their local emergency managers, county judges, or parish presidents for life-saving warning order communication.
So, Rebecca, I mean, where you are, is there a sense that the disaster perhaps for these outlying communities is only just beginning?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one thing worth noting is that in Houston is a city of bayous, and they rise very quickly because they're narrow. It's an urban area, a lot of concrete. In these rural areas, we're talking about whole rivers that are expanding sideways. And so even though the height of the water may not be as high, the devastation can be wider. And so there are whole areas here that we're next to a river called the Colorado River, and official flood stage for that river is 26 feet. It's supposed to crest at 53 feet today. So you can see just whole towns sort of block by block by block going under mandatory evacuation. And then those people, unlike in Houston again, they are not going to be going to shelters. There aren't shelters here. People are going to hotels. They're driving their cars to high ground, either parking lots or along the interstate, and just hunkering down. So I think for the people here, this is a fresh catastrophe every few hours.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced today that he's activating the entire Texas National Guard, all 12,000 members, to help cope with the response needed for Harvey. I mean, do we know more about where first responders are focusing their efforts, especially in places like where you are?
Yeah. In my sort of driving around, I drove between San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, and Houston in the last couple days, and I've seen multiple convoys of National Guard. They are headed mostly into Houston, into Victoria, and to the coast. You know, let's not lose sight of Corpus Christi mm-hmm. and Rockport that were hit so hard a couple days ago. The National Guard is really involved in the cleanup efforts there. But as far as these rural areas, the local municipalities appear to be sort of on their own right now. And they've called for local residents to give them backup. If you have a boat, if you have a vehicle with high clearance. Check on your neighbors, check on the people around you, do what you can to make yourself safe, but then also to help other people get to high ground, because frankly, the local law enforcement doesn't have the resources to rescue everyone.
Right. Rebecca Hersher, part of NPR's team covering the impacts of Hurricane Harvey, she's speaking to us about 70 miles west of Houston, where, as Rebecca, you've been saying, it seems like the disaster's only beginning there. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks so much.
Well, President Trump and the First Lady are heading to Texas tomorrow. They are not expected to visit the areas hardest hit by Harvey in order to avoid disrupting recovery efforts. Meanwhile, this morning, the president approved an emergency declaration in Louisiana. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead politics editor and joins us now. Hi, Domenico.
Hi, Jeremy.
And a storm of this kind can be a defining moment for a presidency. How are the president and his team doing so far?
It certainly can. And at this point, the White House and the president are trying to give the impression that his administration is doing everything that they possibly can, supporting local officials, making sure that FEMA is out there. You've heard from the Federal Emergency Management Agency head repeatedly. The real test is going to come for President Trump first tomorrow, and whether or not he has the capacity for empathy. There have been lots of bright lights shown on other presidents in the past, from Barack Obama to George W. Bush, whether it was Katrina or Hurricane Sandy or any of the events in the past 20 years or so, where social media has now picked up and become so rapid, where things can get shot around as quickly as they can. So real test for the president. And then secondly, the big test is going to be the cleanup efforts and the continuation of whether or not the government has the capacity for competence and can get Houston and surrounding areas, like the reporter was just talking about, in and around Houston to recover.
Well, and we remember that there were huge fights over emergency funds after Hurricane Katrina in 2005 and Hurricane Sandy in 2012. Trump is going into this, whatever the needs may be and whatever the federal government may be able to provide, with a soured relationship with people in Congress and even the possibility of a government shutdown coming over the president's border wall.
Yeah. Well, but I think that a lot of members of Congress are going to look at this disaster, and usually they come together for this kind of funding. You know, I'm sure there will be people talking about the fact that there were some holdouts who did not want to help in New Jersey, for example. There were some folks who, held up funding for that. There were people who didn't want to help. Remember, there was an earthquake in Virginia that it was in Eric Cantor's district when he was majority leader, and he said that he felt that there needed to be offsets for the funding there. Right when the Tea Party was sort of on its rise and had that libertarian streak of on funding. But I think the majority of members of Congress are on board, obviously, with disaster relief. And that'll probably be somewhat of a unifying thing in funding for Congress. I wonder if it'll help facilitate getting the debt ceiling passed as all part of a package and some of the other more thorny issues dealt with and passed over.
Meanwhile, as the hurricane was slamming into Texas on Friday, there was a lot of news coming out of the White House. The pardon of the former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was convicted of ignoring a court order to stop racially profiling Latinos. And in response to that pardon, Senator John McCain, who is a Republican, questioned the president's respect for the rule of law. Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert was on ABC's This Week yesterday defending that pardon.
Just about every modern president ends up with some controversial pardons, but I think the president's been pretty clear on it, and I certainly don't think it's fair to characterize him as not caring about the rule of law.
Domenico, what impact will this pardon have?
Well, obviously, there's a big Friday dump before a big story with what's been going on with Harvey, and this was a good place to put all of that Friday news, for example. But, you know, I think the bigger potential impact here is what kind of message is Trump sending to Robert Mueller, the head of the special counsel's office for looking into coordination on the Russia investigation into whether or not the Trump campaign colluded in some way with Russian officials. Trump is signaling that if it came down to it, he will pardon whoever is necessary.
So you're saying that this pardon of Joe Arpaio may have had more to do with the Russia investigation.
I don't think it had more to do with the Russia investigation, but I think it does send a signal that he would, if he's willing to use the pardon power in this case, why wouldn't he be willing to use the pardon power in another case with some other allies who may be close to him?
The president is under pressure to decide by next week whether he will continue the Obama administration program that enables the so-called Dreamers, young immigrants brought into the country illegally as children, to remain here legally. Do we have any sense of what he will do?
It's not clear because he's been kind of back and forth on some of this. During the campaign, he called it illegal amnesty. During his presidency, he's been a little less outspoken on it. There is a September 5th deadline from Republican attorneys general, most notably led by Ken Paxton, the attorney general from Texas, and who said that they're going to go forward with a lawsuit or trying to fight this if the president doesn't do something on it. So there are a couple things he could potentially do. He could order a halt that takes place immediately, could be one that goes at a later date. He could ask Congress to try to come up with a fix and try to grandfather in some of these DACA recipients. So it's not totally clear what they're going to do yet. The White House is still unclear about how he will go about it. But it would be fascinating if he decides to leave it in place, because then you're talking about failures on both health care and this piece of immigration, two major GOP wedge issues and things that really fire up the conservative base.
That's NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it is that time of year when first-year college students around the country are moving onto campus and beginning freshman orientation. And many of them are bringing their parents along. The former dean of freshmen at Stanford University, Julie Lithcott-Hames, observed this mass migration every fall. And with each passing year, she also observed increasingly bad behavior from parents. Lithcott-Hames wrote about what she saw in her 2015 book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. We spoke with her about the book in August of that year, and today we wanted to revisit that conversation. I asked her what alarmed her about the behavior she saw from parents at Stanford.
Well, I guess what I first saw and my colleagues saw, and let me pause and say this was not only seen at Stanford, but as we learned from dialogue with colleagues at campuses all over the nation and every tier, in the late 90s, parents were starting to not only bring their freshmen to campus, but stay, literally sometimes, but more often virtually, you know, wanting to be involved in their sons and daughters' day-to-day transactions as a university student. And with the rise of parents, we saw the decline in the number of college students who seem to have the wherewithal to be and do and think and resolve and decide for themselves.
I'm not exactly clear what you mean. They were coming and doing what? Or they were staying involved in what way?
Well, they would want to, you know, register for classes, or there might be an overseas studies opportunity, and the parents were expecting there would be an orientation for them. There's a disappointing grade, and the parents want to be the ones to talk to the faculty member. In every case, doing for their 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old what prior generations of 18 to 21-year-olds used to be able to do for themselves.
Uh-huh. And what effect did this have on the students themselves, or that you noticed?
My hunch was this is going to be harmful for these quote-unquote kids. You know, but I'm a lawyer, not a psychologist, so it wasn't for me to say that that was actually true. But, you know, there now in the last 3 or 4 years been studies from the field of psychology linking much higher rates of anxiety and depression to kids who were overparented.
So that's, I mean, you in fact devote an entire chapter of the book to the psychological harms or impacts of this kind of parenting.
Absolutely. I mean, there's this fundamental foundational concept in the field of psychology called self-efficacy, which is this sense that one's own actions and behaviors lead to consequences and outcomes. And if a parent, even with the best of intentions, which you and I know as moms, all parents have, even with the best of intentions, if we're over-helping, over-protecting, over-directing, concierging their every moment, we actually deprive them of the opportunity to develop self-efficacy, which is, in effect, depriving them of the chance to be, B-E, italics, to be a human.
Well, there's a lot of forces at play. I mean, I hear what you're saying about students being less capable in certain fundamental ways when they arrive on campus at the age of 18 and then 19, even 20. But on the other hand, I mean, since you brought up psychology, there seems to be a growing body of research that shows, you know, that the teenage and late teenage brain is still not, you know, fully developed. That's making its way into our legal system, and it's helping us inform what a lot of people are seeing as an expanded adolescence. I mean, that can't all be bad, our understanding of what we really should be expecting from people in their late teens.
Well, boy, I have a lot of thoughts on this subject. You know, number one, if a kid is poor or working class and the U.S. military is their best opportunity after high school, we consider them adults when we sign them up and ask them to go fight and die for our freedoms and for what we believe in. So if we're going to say that people aren't actually adult until 18 and that they're really just emerging adults, let's make sure we apply that equally across the board. I think this concept of emerging adulthood is actually a labeling of the effects of affluent kids whose parents have had the disposable time and money to focus on their every moment. You know, I think it's the side effect of having been overparented. Yes, I agree that apparently one's prefrontal cortex doesn't fully develop until 24. What I'm saying is we know that now. But, you know, it wasn't that long ago we could ask a 21-year-old, you know, to make decent decisions on their own behalf, or an 18-year-old.
Well, Stanford has a diverse student body. I mean, were you seeing differences, if you could tell, between the students who came from your prototypical upper middle class affluent communities versus those who did not?
Yeah. This was sort of a big irony that I wasn't at all expecting. When I became dean in 2002, I thought the students who would most need, you know, a helpful, caring, interested dean would be those from underprivileged backgrounds. You know, 15% of our undergraduates at the time were first in their family to go to college. I expected to need to be there for them. So then imagine how surprised I was that it was among my most affluent students that I saw this inability to have the wherewithal to be an adult. It was terribly surprising. You know, it cut across every ethnicity, this overparenting phenomenon. But poor and working class kids came to the college equipped with a set of skills born of, you know, maybe a harder life experience that enabled them to, you know, interact with the difficulties that, you know, college would throw their way with a little bit more grit and resilience, often in many cases, than their more affluent peers. So this is how affluence can actually end up undercutting a kid's chances to survive and thrive out in the world.
But can you really blame parents for being very concerned about their kids' safety, about wanting to help them as much as possible? I mean, I raise my hand and I know many, many parents who wish they could let their kid ride their bike to school, but it just seems really dangerous. And it's, you know, little things like that on a day-to-day basis that may build up over time. But any one decision makes sense when the parent's making it.
First of all, I'm a parent too, as I've alluded to. I've got a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old, so I get it. And I know we parents love our kids fiercely, and we've just lost sight of the fact that our job as parents is to put ourselves out of a job. So if we've helped at every step along the way, they emerge to chronological adulthood, having been manufactured toward a set of outcomes that wouldn't have accrued without us. So what we have to do as parents is accept the short-term hurts and harms and bumps that come from childhood. Childhood used to naturally provide these learning opportunities. You know, failure is supposed to happen. Overparenting began in the early 1980s when we had a confluence of things all faced by the baby boom. Number one, the fear of stranger danger was born. A few very high publicized awful cases of child abduction and murder led to a nation's sense that there was something terrible likely to happen at every turn. The self-esteem movement was born at the same time, the early 80s. We should praise our kids for every little thing. The playdate was born. In 1984, we have to schedule play and hover over play and intervene when they're not getting along and tell them what to play with. And then A Nation at Risk was published at the same time, saying kids need to be tested more and taught to the test. So all of a sudden, childhood was encroached upon by parents, both indoors and outdoors, homework and play, parks and streets. No wonder, you know, those same kids overparented in the early 1980s became the first generation of college students who came to college with their parents.
Mm. Well, your big critique here is not just the impact that helicopter parenting has on the young people themselves, but actually the impact on society. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, yeah, if you think about it, you know, the first set of kids to be overparented are millennials, and millennials are now the largest generation in U.S. history. And so the practical reality is millennials will be ruling the nation one day. And we in Gen X need to know that when it's our turn to hand over the mantle of leadership to the folks behind us, that they've got what it takes, not only, you know, to thrive in their own homes, in their own relationships, their own workplace, but to really lead our institutions, our government, our nonprofits. This matters at the level of society and country.
Well, we're speaking with Julie Lithcott-Hames. Her new book is How to Raise an Adult. And one of the things that I really loved about the book was that you had a list, basically, of things that an 18-year-old should be able to do. And on that list, talk to strangers, manage their own workload, earn and manage money, handle interpersonal problems. I mean, are those basic level things the kind of things that you're really seeing people just incapable of doing?
Absolutely. It seems basic, but it has become crazy. We are concierging our kids every minute of existence, overhelping. It ends up leaving them unprepared, you know, to do the actual work of living life, paying bills, earning a living, being able to take the initiative and have a work ethic in the workplace. You know, we're depriving them of that.
So what's your recommendation for how we raise kids to be able to do those things, then?
Well, your listeners right now can stop doing these three things if they're doing them. Number one, stop saying we if you mean your son or daughter. We're not on the soccer team. We're not doing the science project. And we're not applying to college. It's their work. It's their achievement. And so on. Number two, stop arguing with all the adults in their lives, teachers, coaches, principals. These folks, for the most part, are adults who are authority figures who deserve our respect, and we need to show our kids that they're deserving of respect. And in those moments when we do need to have a tough conversation with that person, we need to teach our kids how to have that conversation on their own behalf. Number three, finally, stop doing their homework. I don't care of how much you think you understand algebra better than your kid. Of course you do. You've had algebra. It's their turn. The only way they learn is to do the work themselves. You don't want to be that parent that writes their kid's college app or that parent that helps their kid with their work at college or in the workplace. Yes, it happens. You can stop.
Julie Lithcott-Hames is author of How to Raise an Adult. She spoke with us from Stanford University. Wow, what an inspiration and pleasure to speak with you. I'll do my best, but thanks so much for joining us, Julie.
Magna, thanks so much for having me on Here and Now. I really appreciate it.
Let's talk now about the economic impact of Harvey. The recovery effort is expected to take years and cost tens of billions of dollars. The Texas Gulf Coast is home to nearly a third of the country's gas refining capabilities, and much of that has been shut down. And many homes in the path of the rising waters do not have flood insurance. For more on the economic impact, we're joined by Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and her podcast, Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So let's start with oil and gas production. About a quarter of it has been shut down along the Texas coast. What's the likely impact of that?
Well, I think we're going to see an immediate impact on gas prices, not everywhere, but specifically in the South, the Southeast, and the Mid-Atlantic. Analysts are saying that the increase, it could be dramatic, but probably brief. Maybe the only saving grace is that that region down in the South, Southeast, came into this crisis with lower gas prices. They've been seeing prices per gallon, let's say, $2.10 to $2.20 prior to Harvey, and that's about, you know, let's say less than the national average of $2.35 or so. We could see maybe 15 cents a gallon. Hmm. That's where we'll see it first.
But not a major impact at this point, right? Because we have been in a glut of oil and gas for some time.
Right. It's not as if crude oil is trading at $105 a barrel. You know, it's sitting at 50 bucks a barrel. There's plenty of oil all over the country. This is really about shipping oil to these nearby areas that have relied on the cheaper oil. So I don't expect a huge problem at the pumps nationally.
Now, on the issue of flood insurance, you've reported that only 15% of the homes in Harris County, where Houston is, have flood insurance. That sounds like a big problem.
Yeah, it is a huge problem. Now, remember, to qualify for federal flood insurance, the National Flood Insurance Program, you have to live in what's called a designated flood zone. So one part of the problem is that not everyone's in a flood zone. And for those who are not in a flood zone, you might think, oh, well, they've got property insurance, right? They've got homeowners insurance. But homeowners insurance policies very rarely will cover the damage from rising water. It'll cover if a tree falls through your roof, right? Mm. That's covered. But if you say water came pouring into my basement and first floor and everything's ruined, your homeowner's policy probably will not. So those who are not covered are likely to seek federal assistance. assistance, probably from some emergency measures that will get doled out through FEMA.
The Houston area is also home to a large number of commercial ports or large commercial ports. Airlines are flying in and out of Houston typically. It's a big hub for United, and I see that it's not going to be open for days. What are the other economic impacts you're looking at?
Well, I think that the impact specifically on the Texas economy is going to be pretty severe. And you know, it's just it's always like a weird case of timing because the Texas economy has really run counter to the rest of the country. When the rest of the country was having a housing crisis, the housing crisis in Texas was much different. It was much more limited. And as the oil prices rose, Texas economy was strong. Then when oil tumbled, it really took a hit. Just recently, Texas has recovered from those low prices on the oil market and has seen growth of 3.9% in the first quarter from the previous quarter. Big numbers. I think the Texas economy is going to take a hit. It will come back. These are strong folks, and the rebuilding process will add to the GDP, but it is going to be awful and emotional and costly.
And we will be following it all. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Germany holds its election next month. Chancellor Angela Merkel and her Christian Democrats are leading in the polls in her bid for a fourth term. After Germany, the next big European country to hold elections will be Italy sometime next year. The country's Democratic Party holds power right now, even though its leader, Matteo Renzi, resigned as prime minister last year. And the elections matter outside Italy's borders, in part because Italy holds more than $2 trillion of debt and has high unemployment. Joining us now is Rob Dallamonte, a professor of political science at the Luiss School of Government in Rome. He's with us on Skype. Professor, what's at stake in the next Italian election?
Well, basically, the governance of the country and this political stability of Italy, and therefore the financial stability of the euro. Because as you pointed out, Italy is a country which has a huge public debt. We're talking about 2 trillion and 200 billion euros, which is basically $2.5 trillion, so it's huge. Italy is no Greece, is no Portugal, so, and with a debt of that sort, you know, political instability in Italy is a trap. And so this is what's at stake. You know, what kind of government will come out of this election? And the prospects, I must say, are not that good.
Well, tell us a little bit about the prospects. I mean, what are the parties that are competing here?
Correct. Let me put it this way. Today, there are two parties that are between 25 and 30% of the votes. One is Mr. Renzi Party, the Democratic Party, and the second one is the party of the comedian, Mr. Grillo, which is called the Five Star Movement.
And when you say comedian, what do you mean by that?
I mean that he's actually a professional comedian.
Oh.
this professional comedian has created the party, and he has transformed this political movement. He doesn't call it a party. He calls it a movement. And he has transformed this political movement in what it is today, probably the largest political force in Italy. Polls, you know, they're not reliable 100%. But as I say, this political movement, the Five Star, the comedian party, the name is Grillo. Grillo is the name of the comedian. Mr. Grillo party today is estimated between 25 and 30% of the votes. And also Mr. Renzi party is estimated to 25, 30% of the votes. So either one is the largest, at this stage, the largest political movement in the country.
Well, how is the migrant issue playing into this? Because we know that migrants are still arriving on the shores of Italy, and it's become a big political issue.
It's the biggest political issue today. I have to tell you that in the last month, the flow of migrants has slowed down significantly. We got very scared a month ago because in a single day, in 24 hours, 12,000 migrants reached the shores of southern Italy. That's when it was a big alarm. Since then, the government has been acting on different levels, both at the European level, domestically, and also with Libya, whatever government there is today in Libya. The fact is that now the flow of migrants in the last 3 or 4 weeks has lowered down considerably. So the fear is now less than it was 3 or 4 weeks ago, but the issue is still there. It could explode again dramatically anytime, and it could play a big role in the next election.
So, Rob Dalamonte, let me just ask you one more question. If Americans are listening to this and they're interested in what's happening in Italian politics, why does it matter on this side of the Atlantic what happens in the elections?
Well, I think Americans love Italy. Don't you think so?
Yes, I think that's definitely the case.
Yeah, Americans love Italy. There are many Americans who have their roots in Italy, and particularly not only in the South, but many of them in the South. So Italy is looked upon with sympathy and concern. But also, as I said, Italy, never forget, Italy is the second largest industrial economy in Europe after Germany. And it comes ahead of France and Britain and Spain, of course. So in spite of all these problems, in spite of the huge debt that Italy has, Italy is a major player in the world economy. And that's why the other reason that Italy is followed with great attention, what happens here.
That's Rob Dalamonte, who is a professor of political science at LUIS in Rome. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for getting in touch. Have a nice day.
Well, let's go to Vermont now, where each summer a group of developmentally disabled adults gets to spend a month on Zeno Mountain outside the small town of Lincoln. John Kalish has this profile of a unique summer camp.
Will and Peter Halby grew up in Massachusetts and attended the University of Vermont. The brothers loved Vermont so much they bought 273 acres in Lincoln, Vermont, and along with their wives, Vanessa and Isla, started Zeno Mountain Farm. It's not a working farm, but a series of camps that serve different groups of disabled people. People with cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, autism, traumatic brain injuries, and spinal cord injuries. Here's Will Halby.
No one gets paid or pays. Everyone contributes. We cook for ourselves. We clean up after ourselves. And everyone's invited back year after year for the rest of their lives.
No one pays to come to Zeno because the $1,000 a day it takes to run the camp in the summer is covered by donations from thousands of supporters. And the people who help care for the disabled campers are all volunteers.
We all have a passion for this camp because of the way it's structured.
That's Akira Gilbert, a 21-year-old college grad who's been coming to Zeno Mountain since her freshman year. Zeno's structure stems from its founder's adamant belief that there are not campers and counselors here, just friends with varying abilities who care for one another.
I was extremely cautious my first year, and then I realized that everyone is figuring things out as they go, and the best thing was to ask my friends with disabilities that I was working with because they know better than anyone.
I'm 39 years old, and I've been coming to this camp for ages, and I know everybody's name.
Steve Cortez lives in Boston. He has cerebral palsy and walks with crutches.
I come back every year. It's very fun to be in the cabin with every all my good friends. It's nice to live in the woods. I love it here.
Some campers bunk in one of two wheelchair-accessible tree houses. One has a back porch that's 18 feet off the ground and sweeping views of Lake Champlain and the Adirondack Mountains. Musicals are put on at the close of camp, where performers in wheelchairs or on crutches and walkers take to the stage along with able-bodied campers. A.J. Murray, a camper with cerebral palsy, sang a solo from his chair.
It doesn't help to know that you're so far away.
The Halbys have ties to Hollywood, and Zeno Mountain campers help make feature films produced by industry professionals. This year, 31-year-old Ben Moncaba played a bus driver at a fictional Vermont dance camp.
Can we get a sound test real quick?
Moncapa has Williams syndrome, which involves medical problems, but is often accompanied by an affinity for music. So he was thrilled to join other campers at a New York recording studio where they were coached and accompanied by Broadway professionals.
Yes, turn my rocking world around.
I'm so glad that I came back this year because it's lots of fun and we get to do a lot of fun things. It's like a home away from home. That's how I see it.
In the fall, Zeno Mountain Farm will offer a retreat for young adults with cancer. Veterans grappling with PTSD will come to Zeno in December. Next May, the camp will host people recovering from traumatic brain injuries. And in late June, the camp for adults with disabilities will gear up for another season. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott has activated all 12,000 service members in the state's National Guard. And in Houston, officials said today that at least 2,000 people have been rescued from floodwaters. Now, all this damage is, of course, raising questions not only about the state's preparation leading up to this massive storm, but also about the design of its cities. Samuel Brody is a marine sciences professor at Texas A&M Galveston. He's also co-author of the book Rising Waters, The Causes and Consequences of Flooding in the U.S., and he joins us from his home in Houston. And Professor Brody, first of all, how are you and your family doing? What is the situation like?
We've been trapped for now 3 days by rising waters around us. There's no water in our home, but homes around us have been flooded, and there's a lot of high water rescues. We feel grateful that compared to what other people are going through, that we haven't received any home damage yet.
Yeah. You know, obviously there have been historic amounts of rain falling, and that's going to cause problems anywhere. But what is it about Houston in particular, the way it's constructed and built, that has exacerbated this to catastrophic proportions?
That's right. The research that we do looks at the impact of the built environment on exacerbating flood losses. And Houston is a good example of a sprawling metro area where there's been a prolific spread of impervious surfaces across a very large area over the last couple of decades. And when you're replacing grassland or naturally occurring wetlands with pavement and rooftops, there's nowhere for the water to run except into the bayous, and then when those become overwhelmed, into people's homes and property.
Are there other ways to construct urban landscapes that could have at least taken the edge off of the intensity of the flooding now? Because you're right, whenever you replace permeable natural landscapes with impermeable hard surfaces, the water has to go somewhere. But could the drainage system of Houston have been constructed differently?
Since our last very large rain event, Tropical Storm Allison in 2001, there's been a lot done. And the organizations and local officials, they've made a lot of gains in terms of increasing detention, upgrading stormwater management systems, but that's only part of the picture. So this is to really deal with flooding, chronic flooding issues. It's more than putting in larger pipes or widening the bayous. It means looking at regional solutions and regional growth and development. It means working with local residents in terms of education and outreach. It's much more than just replumbing a system.
Hmm. So there needs to be an overall holistic approach, as you're saying. But I've also read that in previous interviews, you've said that Texas has more deaths and injuries from flooding than any other state in the country. So the impacts of flooding have something that is something that the state has long had to deal with, and yet we still find ourselves in this situation with this catastrophe in Houston.
That's right. You know, it's important to note that there's a lot of factors contributing to Houston as the number one place to lose your life in a flood. It's a low-lying coastal plain with very little topographic relief. The soils are very clay-based, and so the rainfall, even if there is no pavement, doesn't drain well into the ground, say, and compared to Miami, which is blessed with very sandy soil. On top of that, we have constructed this impermeable landscape where water collects in low-lying areas, and that's where people run into harm's way, usually in their cars, in an underpass going onto the highway. And when we look at the national data since 1960, this area, it's not just the number one place for human deaths and casualties from floods. It was three times the next place on the list. Mm.
You and your family have been there in your house for 3 days now. What are you going to do over the next couple of days? Are you going to be able to hang in there?
Yeah, we're fine. And, you know, again, I feel grateful compared to the tens of thousands of homes around me. You know, right now, my biggest worry is my 15-year-old not eating through all of our food rations. And so if that's my biggest worry, then I think we'll be fine. It's just more an emotional issue because all of our warnings born from our research projects have come to fruition. But I think we're safe and we're not going anywhere. We're certainly not going to go venture out into the floodwaters. We're going to let the emergency responders do their jobs, and those men and women are literally heroes. And hopefully going forward, the nation, the state, and local authorities get the resources they need to really formulate more regional and systematic plans to mitigate the impact of the next great flood. Mm.
Samuel Brody, professor in the Department of Marine Sciences at Texas A&M Galveston and co-author of the book Rising Waters, speaking to us via Skype today from his home in Houston. Professor Brody, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.